Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for joining us this evening at the University of Glasgow. I'm Professor Neil Joshua, I'm the Deputy Vice-Chancellor here at the University, and it's a great honour and a privilege to be here to welcome you to tonight's 7th annual Jimmy Reid Memorial Lecture, The Struggle for Justice, Equality and Freedom in Scotland. Now, for the audience, just to let you know that there will be filming on behalf of the Reid Foundation and some live streaming on behalf of the Rector. But the audience will not be filmed, and there will be no filming during the questions and answers, so please feel free to ask questions. So the video and streaming is of the presentation, not of the audience. Now, Jimmy Reid was a Scottish trade union activist, politician and journalist from Govan. And tonight's event is brought to you by the Jimmy Reid Memorial Foundation, an independent think tank and political advocacy group founded in the year following his death in 2010. The foundation focuses on formulating evidence-based and practical policy proposals for Scottish society based on the principles formulated by Reid in his lifetime, while also carrying on his legacy of radical political thought through the series of annual public lectures delivered by leading progressive political figures and thinkers of the modern day. In their obituary to Jimmy Reid, the Daily Telegraph described him as the greatest MP that Scotland never had. But to our university community, he came awfully close to having that sort of constituency representative role, as he was elected by our student body to serve as the university's Lord Rector from 1971 until 1974. The position of Rector is unique to the ancient universities of Scotland and is one of the most senior roles within our institutions, a powerful figure elected by students for students, a member of the university's most senior governing body, and a recognised voice of its student body at the highest levels of university decision making. It was in this context that Jimmy Reid made his historic rectoral address almost 50 years ago in this very hall. Known in some quarters as the Rat Race speech, a passionate call to arms that still resonates with the challenges facing Scottish and global society even to this day. It is fitting then that tonight's lecture will be a retrospective on that historic address delivered by our own current Rector, Mr. Amir Anwar, engaging the voice of yesterday's students in a dialogue through the decades with that of our current body. Jimmy Reid remarked in the closing moments of his rectoral address that all that is good in man's heritage involves recognition of our common humanity. For an academic community such as ours, there is no greater nor fundamental a recognition of our common humanity than to engage in an open and respectful conversation with one another as equals. And so on behalf of the university, I'd like to extend my thanks to both the foundation and to our current rector for making tonight possible and for keeping that conversation going. And with that in mind, can I also extend our thanks to all of you for being here this evening and for your support for this Jimmy Reid Memorial Lecture Series and to the university. We are truly grateful and humbled to see so many faces show up time and again to these lectures. And for the first time of you out there, I hope this will prove to be the first in a long line of fruitful engagements. Can I wish you all a thought-provoking and enjoyable evening and ask you to join me in welcoming to the stage Lynn Henderson, the immediate past president of the Scottish Trade Union Congress and the vice chair of the Jimmy Reid Foundation, who will deliver the formal introduction to our speaker. Thank you.
Good evening, brothers, sisters, comrades and friends. Can I first of all thank the Vice Principal and the University for hosting tonight's event. I'm Lynn Henderson, a trade unionist and a member of the Jimmy Reid Foundation. You'll hear more about the Foundation from Professor Gregor Gall about the work we carry out in Jimmy's legacy. But welcome all of you to the 7th annual lecture in memory of Jimmy and to Jimmy's family as well. It's a particular honour for me to be introducing this year's lecture in the resplendent Bute Hall. My alma mater, I've never said that before, my alma mater, the University of Glasgow, Like Jimmy and like tonight's guest, Amr, I too came to this esteemed institution, ancient seat of learning, through a non-traditional route. Although I was a bright working class kid, for multiple reasons, like many of my class and my generation, I never made it to university until I was 29 years old. And even then, I became pregnant in my second year, and I graduated with a toddler in tow. But as a Labour movement campaigner all my life, before, during, and after my time here at Glasgow University, I knew Jimmy Reid, and I knew Amr Anwar as well. And when Jimmy spoke, as you heard in the introductory videos, when Jimmy spoke, his voice made people sit up and listen. And that was a voice that my parents tuned into when the news came on of the UCS on the television or on the radio, or the wireless, as we called it back then. He was our Jimmy, from our class, even though my family were from the east coast of Scotland in the port of Leith, and he was a boy from Govan. So Jimmy's rectorial address here in Bute Hall, delivered in 1972, when you listen to it again today, it's described in 2019. His message that automation should bring leisure time and education should be for life, not work, are still ideals yet to be realised, and their time will come. If I was just a wee girl when Jimmy gave the rectorial address, I was proud to be here for Amr's as a fully fledged adult trade unionist. I first heard Amr, I heard him very loudly, when he was a noisy anti-Nazi campaigning youth, a student and a young man who was on the receiving end of racist violence by the police. And I got to know him better during his subsequent fight for justice. And it was a collective victory against institutional racism for all of us when Amr won the civil action against Strathclyde Police in 1995. Ever since, Amr has reached out in all that he campaigns on to draw people from the labour and trade union movement towards the demand for justice and for human rights. And he carries out his work with humanity and assists families of victims of brutal injustice to feel some dignity in their grief and in their sadness and in their sorrow. And Amr's work with the Choker family, Sheikh Abayu and Clara Pensati is not just legal, it's political, and it's deeply, deeply human. But Amr, the man, is someone I think I've grown up with here in Glasgow, because it's our adopted home, both of us, in this city. And I regard him as a dear friend and one that shares not just a deeply political drive for justice with me, but a passion for a certain genre of music, and good friends and the fun side of family life. So sisters and brothers, I want you to welcome the 7th annual lecturer for the Jimmy Reid Annual Memorial Lecture, Amr Anwar.
Thank you so much, Lynn. Good evening, comrades, brothers and sisters. I want to start by thanking the Foundation. I want to thank Glasgow University. I want to thank the Vice-Principal, Neil Juster, but I also want to thank the Jimmy Reid Foundation and the organisers, and also the family of Jimmy Reid, who are in the front row, for giving me the great honour of paying tribute to a giant in whose shadow we all walk today. Jimmy Reid was often described as the best MP that Scotland has never had, as Neil said earlier. But I believe that Jimmy was so much more than that. Sometimes it's easy to forget the scale of events which Jimmy led and took part in, especially when there was no social media. Every time I see a demonstration over recent years in Glasgow or in Edinburgh, people say, well, that's the largest demonstration there's ever been. But when you look back at the pictures, and you look at the marches that Jimmy Reid was involved in, in June 1971, when the Tory government announced that it intended to liquidate the shipyards on the Clyde, 800 shop stewards in a matter of days organised a mass rally with a trade union stoppage calling for the 24th of June. 100,000 people stopped work. 50,000 people marched on Glasgow Green.
And in July, Jimmy's suggestion, because it was Jimmy's suggestion, of a work-in captured the imagination of workers worldwide. And on the 18th of August, 200,000 workers put down their tools in support of the UCS occupation, and 80,000 people marched on George Square. Jimmy gave a rousing speech in which he said, "Today Scotland speaks, not the Scotland of Edward Heath, Gordon Campbell, Sir Alex Douglas Home, of the Lairds and their lackeys. They have never represented Scotland, the real Scotland, the Scotland of the working people. No title, no rank, no establishment honour can compare with the privilege of belonging to the Scottish working class. Edward Heath, I tell you this, we are going to fight and we're not going to change. Either you will change or we will change the government." The workers went on to win the occupation and they made history worldwide. In 1972, in this hall, wearing the same robes as I, he gave a rectorial address which has stood the test of time. The rest of Jimmy's life informed us, and we are all grateful to the Jimmy Reid Foundation for ensuring his memory sustain us in the battles that lie ahead. And I met Jimmy too, and I was saying to Lynn earlier on, I remember years ago when the Scottish Review was set up, and Bob Thompson got in touch and said, "Jimmy Reid wants to speak to you." And I thought, "Jimmy Reid wants to speak to me." When I went to meet him, I actually could remember trembling because I thought, this is the great Jimmy Reid. But I think, like everyone who's ever met him, he took you under his wing, charmed you, and you were just in awe every time you met him because he was like walking history. And at his funeral at Governall Parish Church, I remember seeing the great and the good, politicians from across the divide, the First Minister, comedians, trade unionists, sporting heroes, and the shipyard workers of Govan who lined the route as his coffin was escorted. There was a great deal said that day about Jimmy, but the memory of his friend, a former shipyard welder, Billy Connolly, is what stayed with me and many others. And what he said was, Jimmy put things simply. I remember him saying that if you look at these housing estates and high-rise flats, look at all the windows. Behind every one of these windows is someone who might be a horse-jumping champion, a Formula One racing champion, a yachtsman of great degree, but he'll never know because he'll never step on a yacht or a Formula One car, and he'll never get a chance. Sadly, for many young people today, behind those windows, things have not changed very much. And we pay tribute to Jimmy Reid, a self-taught intellectual, a philosopher, a trade unionist, a husband, a father, who never sold his soul for high office, never seduced by the offer of a lordship. He always remained rooted in the community from which he came, never scared to tell the truth, often at great cost to himself. Jimmy warned us about alienation. He warned us about the rat race and capitalism race to the bottom, yet our global system still stumbles from crisis to crisis. And some may remember the theatre group, 784, set up in 1971, whose name came from an article in The Economist, revealing that 7% of the nation owned 84% of the country's wealth. If anything, the statistics have gotten worse. It is the same alienation and crisis which gave us Donald Trump, the 45th president of the United States. As a billionaire property speculator, he claims to stand up for ordinary people. His cabinet, made up of white supremacists, misogynists, homophobes, Islamophobes, and conspiracy theories, has more wealth than one third of American households. We should all have seen the writing on the wall. People who feel marginalized, betrayed, never listened to, humiliated by the media, and ignored by politicians are looking for a chance to hit back. The vacuum was filled by the likes of Trump in the United States, but the same is happening in the United Kingdom and the rest of Europe. Our new Home Secretary, Priti Patel, is the latest to reclaim the law and order mantle. I'm sorry for the photo that looks like something out of the Village of the Damned. But for the Tories, there is no problem with violence as long as it is sanctioned by the state. Peacekeeping soldiers can shoot to kill. Security services can engage in rendition and torture. Police officers can restrain and kill unarmed young males. British teenagers groomed by the death cult Daesh can be rendered stateless whilst their babies are sacrificed in the name of public opinion. We supply barbaric regimes with bombs to rain down on innocents. Forests can be burnt to the ground, our seas ravaged and environment plundered, while dissent and free speech can be ruthlessly crushed. And none of this violence is wrong in the eyes of the law as long as it is sanctioned by our government. Donald Trump
and Boris Johnson have ripped away the veneer of legitimacy that masquerades as democracy. The system divides and rules today as it did during the 70s when required. It will scapegoat on the grounds of race, on the grounds of religion, on the grounds of sexuality. And this month, of course, is Black History Month. And I watched, like many, and I spoke to my parents, I spoke to my mother, and I spoke to people in the community about the speech that, for some reason, everybody had watched in the Asian community, many people in the Black community, people from the immigrant community, and they watched Sajid Javid and Priti Patel's conference speeches, paying tribute to his parents. Yet they insult my parents' generation who gave their blood, sweat, and tears to help build this country. A few people of color might make it to the top, but it makes no difference to the millions who still remain at the bottom. It matters not one iota. If Johnson's cabinet is the most ethnically diverse, the only difference now is that they are diverse in their bigotry. It doesn't matter to a gay asylum seeker facing deportation to Iran if it's a brown-skinned home secretary whose parents happen to be refugees from Idi Amin's Uganda, if she then goes on to sign the deportation order. Our children are taught about American civil rights struggle, yet know nothing of the hate that met our families in Britain in the 60s, in the 50s, in the 70s, in the 80s. Riot has always been a lovely four-letter word for the tabloids, but its use in the summer of 1981 to describe the uprisings by entire inner-city populations, black and white, hid the true reason for such an explosion. Between 1976 and 1981, black and Asian communities were under attack from the fascists and the police, and in that period alone, 31 people of color were murdered by racists. Black places of worship, black shops, black centers were targets for brutal attacks, vandalism, fascist daubings, bricks would be thrown through windows, burning, petrol-soaked rags pushed through letterboxes. Day in, day out, black and Asian people, young and old, were subjected to abuse, assault, and murder. Our children today are not taught about Chapel Town, Leeds, where a disabled Sikh woman was burnt to death when a petrol bomb was thrown through hers. About Leamington Spa, where an elderly Asian woman died after racists poured petrol over her and set fire to her sari. About Walthamslow, when Parveen Khan and her three children were burnt to death when petrol was poured through their letterbox at 3 a.m. And I remember as a child growing up in Liverpool, I was always told to walk on the other side of the street when Nazi skinheads approached. And in April 1979, 2,756 police officers, including the notorious paramilitary Special Patrol Group, smashed up 5,000 protesters, black and white, who refused to give fascists freedom of their streets in Southall, London. 342 were arrested, and Blair Peach, a school teacher in the Anti-Nazi League, was beaten to death by the Special Patrol Group. A future Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher, went on air to give a speech that could be given by Boris Johnson today, and she said, "People are really very afraid that this country might be swamped by people of a different culture. The British character has done so much for democracy, for law, and done so much throughout the world, that if there is any fear that it might be swamped, people are going to react and be hostile to those coming in." That was said back in 1978, and Boris Johnson, Priti Patel, and Sajid Javid, I think, just cut and paste and repeat exactly the same words. And in January 1981, 13 young black people were murdered in a house fire in Deptford. 13 young black people. And as usual, the police discounted racial motivation, and there were no arrests, no justice for 13 black young people murdered in their homes. And a few months later, Brixton was swamped by a very different culture, by hundreds of police officers in an operation called Swamp 81, as they attacked local black people. Brixton exploded to be followed with a summer of discontent spreading to cities which had once been the country's chief slave ports, Bristol and Liverpool, provoking a rebellion in over 50 inner cities and towns. Margaret Thatcher was the first to create the hostile environment to win back votes from the National Front. She used the police as an occupying force in our inner cities, in our mining villages, and as a battering ram for picket lines and to criminalise workers defending their jobs. And Boris Johnson also will do whatever it takes to win back votes from Farage's racist Brexit party. The man who as mayor wanted water cannons for the police should be asked now, why does he want 20,000 more police officers? Priti Patel's boasts about abolishing freedom of movement, abolishing freedom of movement, makes the images of the body of three-year-old Syrian Alan Kurdi washing up on a Mediterranean shore in 2015. These pictures should outrageous awe. And for one brief moment, Alan's death sparked universal grief as millions demanded we opened our borders, but yet again, politicians quickly went back to demonizing, to militarizing our national borders and categorizing human beings as illegals. The world condemned Donald Trump for his treatment of refugees, but our own architect of the hostile environment, Theresa May, was responsible for the disappearance of children from the Calais jungle into hands of sex traffickers, deportations of the Windrush generation, and the Home Office vans daubed with Go Home. And long before the likes of Nigel Farage, the grim reality of Fortress Europe for more than 20 years has drowned tens of thousands of refugees, fleeing war, fleeing poverty and climate catastrophe, dehumanizing asylum seekers, Muslims and Romanians. A racist European Union border policy has turned the Mediterranean into a sea of blood, as humanitarians today, saving lives, are threatened with prison sentences of up to 20 years. Desperate migrants are shot at, they're ram-raided on the high seas, they're incarcerated in concentration camps or forced back into the hellholes from which they escaped. And only this year, Channel 4's news released footage of migrant detention camps in Libya, exposing 21st century slavery as men and women were sold at auctions to modern-day slavery owners or sex traffickers. It is worth remembering, of course, that the word Mediterranean is defined as the sea surrounded by Southern Europe, North Africa, and Western Asia. Despite the shared history and culture, the European Union has turned the Mediterranean into a dividing line between the civilized against the undeveloped world. We are ready to bomb their countries, prop up dictators, open the gates of hell, but we will not help those escaping the fire and the hunger we cause. Children like Alan Kurdi, sadly, have always been innocent victims of crimes perpetrated against humanity. And it reminds me of the story of Eli Weisel, born on the 30th of September, 1928. He grew up in the Carpathian Mountains of Romania. And in 1940, over 20,000 Jews were cleansed from the area by the Nazis. And Eli, aged 10, his father, his mother, his younger sister were transported to Auschwitz concentration camp, and he never saw his mother or his sister again. Eli was one of the lucky ones to survive, but he was starved, beaten, tortured in a Nazi slave camp. And as the Red Army moved in, Eli and his father were transferred by the Nazis to the German camp of Buchenwald, where his father also perished. And Eli was liberated from the camp by the US Third Army in 1945, and he went on to make America his home. He became a journalist, he became a professor, and his campaigning work on the Holocaust led to the Nobel Peace Prize. And in April 1999, some 44 years after being liberated from Buchenwald, Eli spoke at the White House to the president and to Congress, and he asked, on the threshold of a new millennium, what would be the legacy of a vanishing century? He talked of how failures cast a dark shadow over humanity, two world wars, countless civil wars, the senseless chain of assassinations, bloodbaths in Cambodia, Nigeria, India, Pakistan, Ireland, Rwanda, Ethiopia, Sarajevo, Kosovo. And he said the inhumanity in the Gulag and the tragedy of Hiroshima and, of course, of Auschwitz, of Treblinka. So much violence, so much indifference. And Eli asked whether it was necessary at times to practice indifference simply to keep one's sanity, to enjoy a fine meal and a glass of wine as the world experiences upheaval. He said the indifference can be tempting. More than that, it can be seductive. Eli spoke of how behind the black gates of Auschwitz, the most tragic of all prisoners were the Musulmaner. Wrapped in their torn blankets, they would lie on the ground, staring vacantly into space, unaware of who they were, strangers to their surroundings. They no longer felt pain, hunger, or thirst. They feared or felt nothing. They were dead, but they didn't know. For Eli Weisel, indifference was not a beginning, but it was an end. Indifference benefits the aggressor, never his victim. whose pain is magnified when he or she feels forgotten, and the political prisoner in his cell, the hungry children, the homeless refugee, not to respond to their plight, not to relieve their solitude by offering them a spark of hope, is to exile them from human memory. In denying our humanity, we betray our own humanity. And in the place that Eli came from, society was composed of three simple categories: the killers, the bystanders, and the victims, of which Eli was one, abandoned and forgotten. Eli asked, "What about the children? When adults wage war, children perish. Do we not see their faces, their eyes? Do we not hear their pleas? Do we not feel their pain? Do we not feel their agony? Every minute one of them dies of disease, violence, famine, some of them, so many of them, could be saved. So all the Alan Kurdis have something to say to us in their death. They have something to say to every politician who has fed voters their twisted politics of hatred and racism. They have something to say to every indifferent European who positively accepts the barbaric system of a fortress Europe, standing on the sidelines as these children struggled for their very last breath. Fortress Europe is our collective shame and begs the question, who decides that one human being fleeing war and hunger is more deserving than another? In this country, the Tories claim they want to build a land of opportunity for all, to build an American-style economy, but you cannot build a land of opportunity for all on the ruins of a million more children in poverty, or where you have to work until you are 70, or perhaps until you are dead. Like Jimmy, my conversion to independence was no road to Damascus moment. Born in England, my parents were of Pakistani origin. My childhood was spent in Liverpool, and I never thought I would one day support Scottish independence. It's a decision I will never regret, but my reasons for doing so are not because I'm a nationalist. Quite the reverse, it's because I'm an internationalist, and I believe that Scotland controls its own destiny. Controlling its own destiny is the only way forward. I have come to realize, however, that no politician knows what the future holds for us. But surely it must be better than the decades of austerity that we are told to expect. Why should people have their jobs destroyed, their services wrecked through closed hospitals, slashed living standards, a future of unemployment in order to pay for the bankers' bailout? With devolution, the people of Scotland took their first step in 300 years to determining their own destiny. 20 years later, we still don't have a real choice. We are dominated by a hysterical anti-immigrant, anti-welfare, low-tax government which parades under an empty rhetoric of positive Britishness. During the referendum, we were expected to take daily lectures about the irresponsibility of independence from bankers, the very people who nearly destroyed the UK economy out of their unrestrained greed. Over the last 5 years, the top 1,000 richest people in Britain have increased their total wealth from £450 billion to the staggering sum of £724 billion in 2018, which is significantly more than the poorest 40% of households combined. This grotesque wealth inequality crushes opportunity and hope. No matter how many hours they work, families struggle to put food on their table. The use of food banks in Scotland has soared by 17%, a record high in the UK. Child mortality is on the increase, while suicide rates spiral as people are driven to despair. And it may be fashionable to blame the Tories for all our woes, but I ask the question, not just about Tony Blair, but also about Gordon Brown, often wheeled out to warn us against independence. As a joint architect of New Labour, he was the Chancellor of Exchequer from 1997 to 2007 and Prime Minister until 2010. And during a decade of annual CBI dinners, the Chancellor boasted that he had done away with boom and bust economics forever, and he had even stabilised the world economy. Yet he signed blank checks for wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and he was messianic in his pursuit of privatisation. Brown claimed that a vote for independence would put at risk 100 years of Labour achievements. But as Chancellor, he was the one who said that it was necessary to break from 100 years of Labour history to turn the UK into a paradise for big business and the rich. Out-Thatchering Thatcher, he turned London into a playground for the super rich, leaving us at the mercy of the bankers. It was Gordon Brown who first raised the slogan, British jobs for British workers, not UKIP. It was Gordon Brown who bailed out the bankers with £1.4 trillion of our money and refused to slash bankers' bonuses. It was Gordon Brown that slashed living standards for millions. And austerity was a price paid by all of us, but not by the super rich. Scotland is one of the wealthiest nations in the world, but child poverty is rising, with almost 25% of children in Scotland officially recognised as living in poverty. And the source of these figures is the Scottish Government. And the figure is expected to reach 38% by 2030. How did we get here? I stand here at this university which gave us Adam Smith, the 18th century philosopher, renowned as the father of capitalism, a proponent of laissez-faire economics. Yet hundreds of years later, we have a unique society in which the free market is only for the poor and socialism is for the rich. A crazy tax system where a person on a salary pays more tax than the director on dividends, who in turn pays more tax than global pirates who threaten the future of entire nations from their £100 million yachts. This year, Google, for example, was accused of avoiding payment of £1.5 billion in UK tax corporation, and they paid only £67 million, 24 times less than what we should have. They are the real tax dodgers. The University of California in Berkeley recently found that for the very first time, the average effective tax rate paid by the richest 400 families in the United States was 23%. That is 1% less than the poorest bottom half of the American households. Crisis? What crisis? We could increase benefits. We could decrease the retirement age. We could work the three-day week that Jimmy Reid spoke about if we could only get the obscenely rich to pay their taxes. And yet workers today face the biggest fall in living standards since the reign of Queen Victoria. And amongst the most vulnerable in society, the number of drug-related deaths in Scotland soared to 1,187 last year, 27% higher than the previous year. The death rate is now nearly three times that of the United Kingdom as a whole and is higher than any other European Union country. The Scottish Government said it was time for drug abuse to be treated as a public health issue, but they are unable to make the changes as drugs policy is reserved to Westminster. And successive Westminster governments are responsible for the death rate. If there was no money in it for organised crime, there would be no playground pushers, and addicts would not commit crimes to pay for their next fix. It's time we realise that the business of fighting drugs is nearly as big as pushing them. The war on drugs is one of history's most cruel and senseless wars. Each one of those 1,187 deaths is our tragedy. It's our guilt. It's our failure to feel the ache and the anguish of the have-nots, where the only option given to our criminal justice system is to maintain a cycle of drugs, crime, prison, and death. We live in a world of upside-down priorities. Scottish prison suicides are at their highest rate in the last decade. And we, according to research, they have said that we may have one of the highest rates of suicide amongst developed countries. Remember William Lindsay? His picture there on the front page of the Sunday Mail. Age 16 last October, the system couldn't find him a place in a children's secure unit, so a sheriff in his wisdom sent him to prison. He had been in and out of care some 19 times since the age of three. He was on a child protection register when he was 1 month old. He had attempted suicide some eight times prior to being sent to prison, and he took his own life within 48 hours of arrival at Polmont Prison. And in 2016 and 17, the cost of a place for a child in custody ranged from £76,000 to £210,000. The annual fee to pluck someone like William Lindsay and to send him to Boris Johnson's Eton would have been only £40,000. Remember Katie Allen, her picture there at the bottom of the Sunday Mail. At 21, she was a vibrant, compassionate, young, third-year geography student at this university, working hard to achieve a degree. She made a mistake, she broke the law, and no one more than Katie accepted that she deserved to receive judicial punishment. However, the sheriff decided, in his wisdom, that there was no alternative to prison. And what Katie endured within Polmont Prison was draconian, it was violating. She was bullied by other prisoners, allegedly singled out for strip searches by staff who failed to notice when they strip searched her the self-harming wounds. Losing all hope, she also took her own life just 1 month away from release. Her parents, Linda and Stuart, are here today in the audience. And they asked me last week, what's the point to campaigning after we received a letter from the Lord Advocate stating that the Scottish Prison Service have Crown immunity from health and safety prosecutions? But then the family said, there are 8 young people who inspire them to carry on. They've only ever met one of them, but they all have one thing in common. They were found hanging alone in a cell in Pullman. Daniel, 20 years old, schizophrenic, considered a low risk of suicide, hung himself 24 minutes after being locked in his cell. Andrew, 19, deaf by hanging 5 days after his arrival at Pullman, alone on Christmas Day. Ross, aged 18, all we know is he died by hanging because his FAI was not published. Jordan, 19, care experience, failed from birth. His mental health nurse had to cancel appointments for therapy, so Jordan tried to help himself. He took an antidepressant, not from a doctor, but from a fellow prisoner, and then he hung himself. Reagan Merchant, just 17, when he also hung himself, shrouded in the whistleblowing accusations of being terrorized. Then the friends, Robert, 18, Liam, 19, both dead after hanging themselves. Liam had been screaming for help, displayed symptoms of psychosis before his death, but the mental health nurse felt a good night's sleep would help. And the young William Brown, 16 years of age, William Lindsay Brown, dead in his cell 2 days after arriving in Pullman, removed from suicide watch some 24 hours before. And then there was Katie, Linda and Stuart's daughter, loved beyond measure at 21, despite physical signs of extreme distress, who lost all hope. Every month, a prisoner takes their own life. Self-harm, abuse of power, drugs and assault are the daily reality of life behind bars. And the horrifying statistics exposes our prison system that kills you a little bit every day. Crushing dreams, breeding bitterness, rage and frustration. 2/3 of our prisoners have numeracy skills below that of an 11-year-old. 48% of prisoners have a history of debt. 25% of prisoners were in care as children compared to 2% of the population. 25% in care. 70% of our prisoners suffer from 2 or more mental disorders. For the general population, this figure is 5% for men and 2% for women. Nearly 40% on conviction have a problem with drugs. And you can bet your bottom dollar that once they're in prison, that is the easiest place to find prison, and that drug addiction will increase. Locking up people in dungeons of despair doesn't rehabilitate anyone. It institutionalizes violence, it dehumanizes, and it alienates. And I am tired of all the politicians squabbling, playing games and scoring points. It is time that they listen to the families, listen to the voice of the voiceless. Nelson Mandela said, a nation should not be judged by how it treats its highest citizens, but by its lowest ones, how it treats its lowest ones. We as a nation are failing. We recently saw the story about the death of Alan Marshall 4 years ago. He was a terrified young man suffering a psychotic episode, restrained violently by up to 17 prison officers for 45 minutes. Evidence in that 4 years disappeared. People are alleged to have lied and covered up. Despite the CCTV exposing brutal violence, there was not one criminal charge, not even a charge of misconduct brought against the prison officers. And then, of course, in the case of Sheku Bayo, in May 2015, Kakodi police responded to calls of a black male acting erratically with a knife. 6 police vehicles were dispatched. Sheku was attacked with CS spray and batons. He had no knife on him, nor did he brandish one. He was face down on the ground within 27 seconds, restrained by up to 9 officers, handcuffed, ankle restraints, leg cuffed, and he would struggle to breathe. Lost all consciousness within minutes and died. And his body was covered with up to 54 separate lacerations and bruises. And in his death, he was criminalized and smeared. And it has been 4 years, 5 months, and still his family, also here tonight, have not been told whether the police will be prosecuted. There is something deeply shameful about a country and a system where people are unlawfully killed at the hands of our protectors, and the perpetrators remain free. So yes, I do want independence, but I don't want the same injustice system that we have in England and Wales. It has to change up here. We have control of our justice system. We had control over the police. And in conclusion, I want to say this. Asylum seekers, the poor, young people are not only demonised and exploited, but they are negated as human beings, objects of hatred, invisible in their misery, and we cannot wait until those who are desperate and vulnerable explode with fury. What is ominous is a global sense that the damage may be irreversible. The lakes, the rivers, the forests will not rejuvenate. The arms race is unstoppable. Lands are poisoned by insecticides and chemicals will not be restored. Jimmy Reed gave his speech, his rectorial speech, in 1972. But in 2019, we are still fighting for the right to life. In the younger generation, of course, there has always been a spirit of dissent. And usually that voice starts as a minority, but when it unites with millions of protesting voices, that dissent becomes our hope. The traditional form of resistance may have changed, but there is so much to give us hope today. Greta Thunberg, like Malala Yousafzai before her, for some reason terrifies certain men. Well, it's time for them to get the hell out of the way. The Swedish teenager did not know a year ago when she led a solo protest outside her parliament that she would unleash a worldwide wave of climate strikes. The millions of young people taking to the streets show the power of resistance beyond parliament and elections. A new generation of feminists has led a global mobilization of women. The Me Too movement has been smashing through patriarchy across this planet. In Scotland, the Tai Campaign, an LGBTI group of activists founded in 2015, acted as a juggernaut to ensure that in 2018, the Scottish Government announced LGBT inclusive education would be implemented across all state schools, the first anywhere in the Western world. The people who line the streets of Germany to welcome Syrian refugees in the aftermath of Alan Kurdi shamed politicians with their compassion. We have seen so many eruptions of compassion and resistance. The global anti-war movement, the Extinction Rebellion on their streets now, Occupy Wall Street, Black Lives Matter, a successful equal pay 12-year campaign by 8,000 women of Glasgow City Council. And we should also support all the other low-paid workers who exist in Scotland. I include in those low-paid workers the janitors at this university, the cleaners at this university who are in dispute with management. Social media has helped link activists, making it a tool of global dissent. And pessimism may well be the prevailing mood, but since the dawn of civilization, we have seen the tyranny of empires, but the history is littered also with the ruin of such empires. And each ruin is a monument not only to mankind's failures, but to the inherent ability of mankind to fight for freedom and to overcome tyranny. And that is what Jimmy Reed believed in. And when we leave this hall tonight, we must do so united, because there is no longer time for the petty and the destructive divisions of the left, no time for indifference, no time for alienation. We must act now before it is too late if we are truly to honour the memory of Jimmy Reed. Thank you.